privilege for me to introduce Brother Tom Riggiarello, one of the elders from the Chicago Bible Students. He's going to speak to us on the subject, dealing with discouragement, Brother Tom Riggiarello.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. Good to be here, Brethren. Jackson's been one of my favorite conventions for a long time, and I'd like to thank the Jackson Brethren for giving me the privilege of serving here. You spilled the water. We're off to a good start. Never spoken to so many chairs before. I think it'd be a little more intimidating if they were all full. Brethren, I think the area of discouragement is by far the most common problem that all of us have to deal with in our daily lives. And I think it can also be one of the most devastating and difficult obstacles to deal with in the narrow way. You know, sometimes it's amazing the power that discouragement can have over our lives. It's something that I've experienced many times, and I'm sure all of you have as well. It can be so intense that it can make us do and say things that even seem irrational at times. It can muddle the calm, reasoning thought process that really should control our lives. It can take us to such depths of despair that we might even feel that there's no way out of our problems and the things that are discouraging us. And it really is a major factor in contributing to the loss of the joy and contentment that we probably first felt very deeply when we consecrated. That seems to be one of the things that Jesus loved about the children. There was a lack of worry. There was a lack of fret about problems in life. They cried, it was over with, and they were happy again. Very simple way of looking at life. Something that we often lose as we grow older. You know, at a recent convention, I was talking to one of the brethren, and it was very clear that this particular brother had reached a point in his life where things were very negative, where his life was very difficult. He was discouraged about the way his life was going, about the many problems he faced, about the uncertainties of his future. And he summed up his feelings by saying that he saw life as something that simply had to be endured. It was one trial after another. And there was really no joy or contentment in his life. It was just one struggle after another. And, you know, I felt very bad for him, but I could really understand what he was saying, because I felt that way often, that life is one trial after another. My answer to him was that it was very important to have a positive mental attitude in life, that we have to try to look at things from a positive perspective. That can make such a difference in the attitude we take towards life. Now, my answer wasn't very satisfactory to him, and as we talked further, I could see why. His response was that, well, those are very easy words to say, but my problems come every day. They're there day after day. I go to work, they're there. I go to meetings and they're there. I go home and my problems are there. I face them day in and day out, and they just wear me down. You know, what I said about a positive mental attitude, I think, is still true. But when you tell that to a discouraged person, it rarely does any good. Because having a positive mental attitude is really a goal. It's a goal from a process of reaching that goal, something to strive for at the end point. You don't start down here and have the positive mental attitude up here and say you have to have it and immediately jump up there. It's a process. It's an education. It's a learning from our experience how to attain that positive mental attitude. I can't think of anything in life that has as much negative effect on our spiritual lives as discouragement. Discouragement, affects those around us. And it's something maybe we don't think about too often. When you come home from work and you're feeling really down, you are going to affect your family, and you're going to bring them down with you. It's a very important aspect to consider, how we affect those around us. The spirit of discouragement can be tremendously painful. And as I said, it's detrimental to our new creatures. And because it's such an important factor in our lives, I think we need to look at it. We need to analyze it. We need to have a step-by-step procedure almost, how to overcome discouragement, how to conquer it in practical ways. We're going to try to do that to a certain extent. I'm sure much of what we'll say will sound theoretical. But I think the goal in our lives quite often is to make the theoretical practical, to bring our theology down to a level where we can live it day by day. And this is one area where we really have to work at that. I'm convinced, brethren, that we cannot overcome discouragement by ourselves. We have to be willing to look outside of ourselves for help, so that inside we can gain the peace and tranquility which should be a common part of our Christian lives. I'm sure many of you, brethren, have overcome discouragement by the Lord's grace, but I've noticed in my life that these feelings often go in cycles. Sometimes I feel on the mountaintop, other times I feel very low and depressed. We need to know how to stabilize it, how not to have the deep valley depressions. Let's begin by looking at just a few of the causes of discouragement. Of course, is a broad area. There's probably as many causes of discouragement as there are brethren in this room. One cause of discouragement which affects many of us is really the feelings that this brother I spoke about conveyed. The feeling that our lives are just not going the way we would like them to, or the way that we planned our lives to go. And it seems a very legitimate cause for discouragement. No one likes to see their plans not work the way they were planning them to work. In our consecrations, we said that we gave our lives over to the Lord for Him to do as He pleased with. Simple concept. And you know, if He would have taken our lives and taken it as a piece of machinery and fit it into a big machine, and He would control the way the machine would work and everything would be harmonious and it was all up to Him, that would be great. But He doesn't do that. He says, take your life back and be a steward of your life. And you control your life and you work it out. And I will supervise it. You make the decisions from day to day, and you do your best to become Christ-like. He made it very difficult for us, brethren. The other way would have been much easier if He would have just controlled and turned all the knobs and buttons and our life just went very smoothly. But He didn't choose to work that way, because He views the exercising of a spiritual mind in searching for His will to be far better than always making His will clear to us from the start. Because there's growth and development in that searching process. It's the difference between a child who simply learns to blindly obey a parent and a child who learns to understand the reasons for obedience and who comes to love the principles underlying the rules. The reasoning process which that child goes through will eventually make him more mature, make him more able to think like his parent. So the growing process is much more difficult. The effect of God's approach of giving our lives back to us often leaves us in uncertainty. And that uncertainty is often a cause of discouragement for us. Discouragement takes on many faces. It comes from financial problems, marital problems, problems in dealing with the brethren, even sometimes doubts about our personal relationship with the Lord. Discouragement often comes after the loss of a loved one and the loneliness, the missing of that loved one. And we're often discouraged over our many failures and weaknesses. It would be good if we looked at just a few scriptural examples of some people who became discouraged and how they dealt with their discouragement, how the Lord helped them with it. Let's look at a brief experience in the life of Abraham. It's found in the 14th and 15th chapter of Genesis. We think that the answer for Abraham should form a basis in our dealing with discouragement. Just in general, in the 14th chapter, the context is describing the capture of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in the capture, all the inhabitants were taken prisoners and their possessions were taken as spoils. And this included Lot and his family. So there was an effect on Abraham through Lot. When word reached Abraham that his nephew Lot was taken prisoner, he responded by gathering 318 of his men and pursuing the army, which had taken Sodom and Gomorrah. He overcame them, and he freed the entire captives. When offered the recaptured spoil as a reward by the king of Sodom, Abraham, almost in disdain for the ones he saved, responds in the 14th chapter, verse 23, that he would not even take a thread or a shoe latchet, lest the king should say that he had made Abraham rich. But the entire event to Abraham, I think, was distasteful. He did not like the fact of going to war. He was a man of peace, but he felt a responsibility for his nephew. On reprint 2853, Brother Russell suggests that at this point in his life, Abraham was downcast and discouraged. He was 84 years old. He was wealthy, but he still felt like he was a stranger in this land that God had brought him to. He still felt alien. The article goes on and says that he had no children to cheer and enliven and comfort his home. Even his nephew Lot, whom he had not detained unwillingly, had preferred the companionship of the wicked and had left him. And even when rescued from his enemies at the cost of danger and sacrifice, he had not appreciated the matter fully and still preferred the strangers. No wonder poor Abraham felt as though his life, passing quickly by, was a comparative failure. No wonder he felt discouraged. Now, we never think of Abraham like that. We never think of him as feeling that his life was a failure. To us, he was the father of faith. He was the beginning of faith. And yet, at this point, he felt he was a failure. How many of us have looked at our lives and felt the same way? That our lives are comparative failures. Our hopes, our plans, our desires may seem so seldom to be fulfilled. Family and brethren may not respond to us the way we would like them to, just as Abraham's family was not responding to him. Like Abraham again, we may have to do things that we prefer not to do, and yet feel a responsibility to do. You know, in many ways, though we live thousands of years later, our lives aren't really that different from Abraham or from others who tried to serve the Lord. In Genesis 15:1, the Lord responds to the feelings of Abraham. It says, "After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward." This verse is one of the underlying principles that we should keep in mind when combating discouragement. Abraham took comfort in this word, "I am thy shield. I'm your protector. I am your ultimate source of victory over your enemy." Brethren, those words are as true for you and me as they were for Abraham. They're more than theoretical promises. They're more than empty hopes. They're real and living words. It seems that Abraham may have feared a reprisal from the armies that he had attacked. And so the Lord tells him to fear not. Believing that God is the real comfort from our fears, we need to turn to him first when struggling with discouragement. We need to see things from his perspective and fully realize that he is able to deliver us and bring happiness out of a difficult situation, even if it seems impossible to us. In Isaiah 26:3, it says, "Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, not by removing his troubles, not by removing his problems, not by lifting him up away from the world, but whose mind is stayed on thee." Another antidote to Abraham's discouragement was God's reminder that "I am thy exceeding great reward." You know, so often we get caught up in evaluating our successes or failures by the world's standards. The world has many rewards it gives for work and diligent effort. And sometimes when we don't measure up to their standards, we can naturally feel like failures because we're human. We have the same human emotions as the world. Their standard, their rewards, are related to what kind of home do I live in? What kind of car do I drive? What kind of job do I have? How do my neighbors view me? What's my position in society. But the Christian standard for success is much more difficult to gauge than these things. The advantages we have are far more subtle and elusive than simply how much money we might have in our checkbook. That's an easy thing to measure. Measuring success by the world standard is very simple. You've either got it or you don't. But spiritually, it's much more difficult. The reward that God was speaking of here was not just the fulfillment of a future promise for Abraham or for us, but in a real practical way, God's rewards come to us daily through the peace and contentment, which comes from viewing our success from a spiritual standpoint, by making His standards our real goals in life, not mixing in the world standards. In that reprint article I mentioned, 2853, it's summed up like this. It says, "The having of God for a friend and counselor and guide was to be esteemed far beyond every earthly interest and blessing. All of these together are inferior to the one great thought that God, the Creator, is ours, our Father, our God, our friend." Brethren, we need to spend our thoughts trying to understand and appreciate who we're really dealing with. This is not an empty sky when you look above. There is someone there with power and majesty, and He's promised to be our Father. We need to bring that to a practical level and really see that that's true in our daily lives. We need to try to fully appreciate what He's calling us to the divine family. Difficult concept to comprehend, but meditating and thinking about it is crucial for our spiritual welfare. Often when I'm discouraged, and I can rationally analyze the source of that discouragement, it often comes because I'm measuring my success by the world standards. We have so much to be thankful for, so much to be appreciative of. We have a counselor who cannot err, who cannot make a mistake. We have a friend who possesses all the wisdom of the universe, who knows all the answers, who molds and prepares our experiences to make us better people, and one who will make us usable in the greatest work ever performed in the universe, the resurrection and uplifting of the world of mankind. Brethren, these thoughts are overwhelming to me, and they can lift us out of sorrow and depression. You know, God, we said, has all the answers, and obviously we don't. But when we go to Him and search for the answers, it's not like He's holding all the cards to His chest and says, "I'm not going to tell you. I don't want you to know because I want it to be hard for you." It's not done out of cruelty or impatience with us, but because He knows the searching process is good for us. The uplifting of the Spirit seems to be the effect that God's words had on Abraham. But notice one thing. His problems hadn't changed. His sojourning in the land still continued. The feelings of Lot towards Abraham were the same as before. Abraham's desire to have a son were as strong as they ever were. But in chapter 15, verse 6, we're told that Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. He believed. Really believing His promises is the key that unlocks our hearts to peace and contentment. Let me say that again. Really believing His promises is the key that unlocks our hearts to peace and contentment. In our belief, we often have to be patient, because I think we've all seen that He works by a different time clock than we do. We need to trust His wisdom, that things are working out for our spiritual welfare if we've committed ourselves into His hands. In keeping with this, Paul says in Hebrews 4:3, "We which have believed do enter into rest." Rest and belief go hand in hand. Another scriptural example of one who was deeply discouraged was our Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane. We read one of the accounts in Matthew chapter 26, beginning with the 36th verse. Matthew 26:36. "Then cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane, and said unto the disciples, Sit ye here while I go and pray yonder. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Then saith he unto them, My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me. And he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed. Notice how deeply troubled Jesus was. He says, My soul is exceeding sorrowful. The Diaglot says, My soul is surrounded with a deadly anguish. Jesus was at the lowest point in his life. He was deeply discouraged, sad, and upset. Seems that the Father was beginning to turn his face away from him, and Jesus didn't know why. God was gradually severing that personal, deep relationship and communication that they had with one another. We feel that this was the deepest and most painful part of the sin offering cup. Not yet fully understanding the need for that, that it would give him the understanding of man's position, Jesus feared that it might indicate that had been unfaithful in some way. And if he had been unfaithful, there would have been no resurrection for him. Brethren, if we were there, could we have said to Jesus, Just have a positive mental attitude, it'll be okay. Of course not. There was a real, legitimate reason for his feelings. It wasn't mental instability or lack of faith. There were things happening that he simply did not understand as of yet. How did he handle his fear, his sorrow, and his discouragement? In dealing with this unexpected pain, Jesus used two important tools in his spiritual warfare. First, he turned to the Father in prayer, seeking a reason for the experience. In Hebrews 5:7, we're told that he offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears. God is always happy for us to ask him why we're having certain experiences, to search out his thoughts, his mind, his desires in it. He delights in seeing us try to determine his will. As I said, not because he wants to hide it from us, but because he wants to develop us in the thought process. I believe in general, brethren, that trials very seldom have hidden or mysterious reasons. The Lord permits them for positive spiritual instruction and education. If at first we fail to grasp the meaning of our trials, we should not stop asking him why or searching and digging for his answers. Another reason that prayer is so useful is that through it we can verbalize what we feel is wrong. It focuses our minds more clearly on the problems, and it seeks a higher counsel that recognizes that we don't have all the answers, recognizing that we need help in sorting out is a very important first step in finding the answers. The second tool that Jesus used in combating these powerful emotions he was struggling with was the brethren. He brings his disciples into the garden with them. To the larger group he says, Sit here, and he takes three with him. And when the four of them were alone, he tells them a little bit of his struggles. He opens up. But then he tells them to wait and watch while he goes a little further and prays. Did you ever think of what the three were supposed to be watching for? Do you think it was the band of enemies that Jesus knew was going to come and arrest him? I don't think so. Jesus knew they were going to come. He was willing to be arrested. He was willing to let them kill him. I don't think he was afraid of that or worried that he had to tell the disciples to watch for them. But Jesus needed the love and support of those brethren. He was asking those closest to him that they watch with him. He wanted them to be awake and aware that he was struggling and that he was in great need and that he wanted their help. Even though he knew they couldn't answer his questions. He knew that they couldn't even understand the struggle that he was going through. And yet he wanted their moral support. He wanted to lean on them a little bit, feeling their concern and their love. The second powerful tool that we need to use in overcoming discouragement is also our brethren. But it's not enough that we know each other just on a casual basis, that we're just Sunday acquaintances. That kind of shallow relationship will never have the depth of support we need to lean on when we're tired and discouraged. Our brotherhood has to go beyond that. It has to go beyond merely duty. The Lord wants us to serve each other, not just because we know it's what He wants us to do, but because from our hearts we really want to serve. You know, as a parent, one of the greatest joys I have is seeing the times that my children play together. When one of them is hurt, the other comforts. When one of them is sad, the other tries to cheer him up. It doesn't happen often enough, as far as I'm concerned, but when it does, it's one of my greatest joys. Brethren, I believe that it's only in the depth of friendship that we can comfort one another, that we can feel good about coming to one another with a troubling problem, knowing that we will find a receptive, understanding heart. The disciples loved Jesus very much, but they couldn't really enter into His pain or sorrow. They were not new creatures yet. They had not developed the sensitivity of a good spiritual listening ear. They really only understood things that they could see or touch or hear. The term spiritual warfare was not even in their vocabulary yet. And so you and I have a great advantage over them. Brethren, you and I, more or less, are fighting the same spiritual battles. And yet there's a great range of experience amongst the brethren. It's a source of strength that we need to tap, that we need to become a part of. Being a friend means being a good listener, being able to just tell when something is wrong. You know, we have a very large ecclesia in Chicago, and it's impossible to have that kind of relationship with everyone. And so we need to seek out the one or two or three brethren that we can get really close to. Any of us feel that we don't already have friends amongst the brethren like that, then we should seek to find them. Not only to have support for our times of need, but to be supportive as well, to become part of the brotherhood in a real practical sense. You know, even the world recognizes the need for those types of relationships, and it uses a real nice term to describe it. It calls these kindred spirits. We all need to have kindred spirits, brethren, friends who understand the struggles of the narrow way and who would be able to help us probe why we're feeling the way we do at certain times. And then as listeners, we need to exercise wisdom in knowing how to comfort brethren. That's an important position to be in, comforters of the body members of Christ. Sometimes we can give wrong advice, so we need to watch our words carefully so that we don't cause more harm than good. Remember the comforters of Job, how their comfort brought accusations. They comforted him by saying, "You must have done something wrong, or God wouldn't have been punishing you this way." The one who brought real comfort was the slowest to speak. He was the slowest to evil surmise about Job's secret sins. It took 3 days before Elihu even said a word. He let the others speak. He told Job, when he did speak, that he recognized that Job was a righteous man, but that even Job now was reasoning from a wrong premise. You know, because of the accusations of the three comforters, Job defended himself. And he defended himself to such a point that he said, "I'm more righteous than God." And so Elihu tells him, he corrects him on that point. Elihu showed a great deal of wisdom in putting Job back on the right track. He was gentle with him, but he was firm. He didn't tell Job phony things just to make him feel better, but he gave a balanced account of how Job should view his troubles. Paraphrasing Job 34:29, Elihu says that if God had chosen to give you a wonderful, peaceful life, then there's no one who could have changed that. But obviously God has permitted you to experience trouble and pain in your life. He tells Job that God has a right to do that. He has a right to order the affairs of your life. And yet he says that these painful experiences were not sent because Job was a great sinner. In fact, Job was more righteous than the three comforters. Elihu was a good friend. He was slow to give advice, but when he did, he was fair, open, and honest about what he thought Job's attitude should be. Very important part, he admitted really that he didn't know why God was permitting these things. And yet there were some underlying principles which Job or Elihu or anyone should not violate. It's important again, brethren, that our comfort and advice be educated with knowledge and understanding. When we don't know the answer to someone's problems, we should be quick to admit it and realize that it's just as important to be a listening ear and a shoulder to lean on. This brings us to another antidote for discouragement, which is closely linked to friendship, and that is communication. I don't know how you are, brethren, but I often find it very difficult talking about things that are troubling me. I tend to bottle them up inside and not want to talk about them and just isolate myself and be alone. We're emotional creatures, and these emotions have to be dealt with. When we hold things inside, our minds almost always exaggerate them and blow them out of proportion. Open communication helps to analyze what's discouraging us. How many times have you felt discouraged and not really known what was discouraging you? It almost sounds unbelievable that something could be bothering us and not fully recognize what it is. But it is possible, because I've experienced it. I know it's possible. It's obvious that before we can overcome a problem, we have to recognize what the problem is. That's just as true with dealing with discouragement. The first step to victory over discouragement is to reveal the reason for the discouragement. It's possible to hide those feelings even from ourselves. It sounds so simple and obvious, but so often we don't do it. The Apostle Peter tells us in 1 Peter 1:13 to gird up the loins of our minds and be sober. Sometimes the answer to understanding what's bothering us is simply to have the strength to sit down with ourselves and try to put our emotions aside, simply asking ourselves the questions, what exactly is bothering me? You might even find it helpful to write yourself a letter, to verbalize it on paper, to help you sort things out. Unless we know exactly what's bothering us, we simply can't deal with it. Communications with ourselves, very important. And communication with our brethren, with our kindred spirits, is marvelous. It's like opening up a window to a stuffy room and letting in some fresh air. If you're discouraged, communicate. Talk to the Lord about it. Talk to yourself about it. Verbalize it. And go to one of your kindred spirits and say, I'm feeling down. I just need someone to talk to. There's a great advantage in airing things out with someone who is not emotionally involved with our discouragement. There's a better possibility that this friend will be able to analyze our situation without the emotion that often clouds our thinking. And one side advantage, which is really a great advantage, is our relationship with that kindred spirit will bond us closer together as we fulfill the words of Paul, bear ye one another's burdens. I'd like to look at discouragement now from a somewhat different perspective for a few minutes. And that is that discouragement can be a good tool for spiritual growth. Now, that might sound strange, that discouragement can be something positive, but let me give you a hypothetical situation to illustrate what I mean. I'm not putting it quite right. Brother A is very discouraged about his spiritual life. He feels that his relationship with the Lord has gone nowhere. In fact, he feels that years ago he felt much closer to the Lord than he does today. He's despondent about almost everything that happens in his life, and he just feels that he's in a rut and he can't get out of. And he comes to you. What would you say to him? Well, like so many things in life, there's no magic formula. You can drink and have it all cured and go away. But we might start by asking him a few questions. And again, we have to be careful not to make our questions, not to make our counsel accusatory or derogatory. Our aim simply has to be to help, and if possible, assist the brethren to find the answers for themselves. One question we might ask this hypothetical brother is very simple. What do you expect your life to be like? What do you expect out of life? What do you foresee a good, happy life to be like? Sometimes we need to sit down and express what our expectations are, so that we can see if they're reasonable and we can see if they're what the Lord would want us to do in our lives. Too often we just let things happen without much thought, just a random, haphazard existence. Now this brother might answer that he would like to have greater peace and contentment. He would like to have a closer personal relationship with the Lord. He would like a better relationship with his family and his brethren. He might also add, if I had a better job or a better financial position, then I wouldn't have to work the long hours I do. There are many things involved in his wants. And then my next question might be, well, what are you doing to achieve those goals? If you're talking about a relationship with the Lord, how is your communication with him? How is your prayer life? And I don't mean just at night before you go to bed, but how often do you talk to him in your mind during the day? How often do you turn to him and say, Lord, is this what you would want me to do? His answer, since he's my hypothetical brother, I can give his answers. His answers might be, well, I'm usually too tired at night to spend a lot of time in prayer, and I really hadn't thought about praying during the day, in the few minutes I have here and there. The day is pretty well filled up with temporal things. And then again, I would press the point. How much time do you spend studying? How much time do you spend with the brethren? Do you really have any close friends amongst the brethren that you can say are kindred spirits? And his answer probably is, not really. I'm very busy. My point, brethren, is that often we're discouraged over circumstances that we can control. We often have to make a concerted effort to shape our lives as closely as possible to what the Lord would want us to do. We need to use our reasoning and our knowledge of the truth in discerning a lifestyle which would be for our highest spiritual welfare. We have to make the effort to come to meetings looking for a spiritual uplift, not just coming out of duty because we've grown up that way. We have to work at building the friendships that we all need. And of course, we have to make the time for prayer and meditation. Peter calls this all being sober. You know, meditation is really a sorting out of things in our lives. It's putting values on different areas as to their relative importance. If we put a value on temporal things at 90% and spiritually at 20%, you know what the effect of that kind of lifestyle is going to be. And sometimes we do that without even knowing that we've done it. Brother A's discouragement was a result of his not placing proper priorities in spiritual matters. He spent so much time providing for temporal matters that spiritual matters sort of fell by the wayside out of neglect. To sum up my advice, I would say, spend more time in prayer and meditation, seeking the Lord's direction in your life. Invest more time in spiritual friendships and spiritual fellowship. Make the study of the truth a larger part of your life. Don't be afraid to jump in and dig into the truth and look for the deep meanings. Look for the hidden meanings. Study in depth and see the practical application of that study. Discuss the truth with your family. Try to elevate the spiritual atmosphere of your surroundings as much as possible. I think that when we put this emphasis on spiritual matters, much of the discouragement we face will be gone. Remember how the Apostle Paul and Silas were singing hymns and rejoicing at midnight while they laid in the deepest, most inner, darkest part of the prison with their feet in stocks and their backs lacerated and torn. They sung. Why weren't they discouraged? Well, I think there were two reasons, primarily. First, they believed that their lifestyle had been pleasing to the Lord. They believed they were there because they were being pleasing to him. It gave them a great sense of peace to feel that way. There was much thought and preparation on their part in ordering their lives to be servants in whatever area the Lord would be pleased to use them in. Now, obviously, they didn't plan to be in prison, but their lifestyle consecrated to the Lord brought them there. This order and thought was rewarded by allowing them to suffer for Christ. Their attitude was so opposite of the kind of attitude that would sit in prison and moan and complain that, why am I going through this? They saw it as a real privilege. They had the positive mental attitude. But most of us obviously have not been asked to go to prison or to be beaten for the Lord as they were. But we should look at our lives with the same intent to live a lifestyle that would be pleasing to him. If we do that, we can have a sense of happiness that Paul and Silas had, regardless of what the surroundings are. The second reason these brethren were able to rejoice in the experience they were having is the same point we mentioned earlier. They believed God's promises that if you suffer with me, you will reign with me. Whatever form that suffering takes, we need to keep this promise before us. Let's move on to another area that's related to discouragement, and that's the area of discontent. Reprint Article 2351 uses Hebrews 3, 5, and 6 as its theme text. And Paul says there, "Be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee or forsake thee." That article has an interesting beginning. It opens up by saying, bad advice, very bad advice, says Mr. Worldly Wise Man. It is because this advice has not been followed that we of America have made such progress within the past century. It is because the workmen of the United States are ambitious, energetic, and not content with such things as they have, but constantly trying to make two blades of grass grow where one grew before, trying to put $10 in the bank to one that was there before, that our nation has stepped rapidly to the front and become noted for the genius, thrift, and progressiveness of its people. You know, the argument of Mr. Worldly Wise Man sounds logical, doesn't it? And we see some truth in what he says, that ambition and discontent of the people have led to many progressive changes in our society. And yet we believe that the real progress has come as a result of the Lord's presence, as is preparing the elements for the kingdom. It's been the Lord who has lifted the veil, is lifting the veil of ignorance and superstition. The real question is, what has the ambition and discontent done for the individual who had it? Let's look on a more minute scale rather than on the scale of society. Discontent permeates the entire fabric of our society. It smothers sense of peace and tranquility. It's always seeking for more. It's never content with what it has. If it has this much, it wants this much. It's always working to go further. In that same article, Brother Russell describes people who are unhappy with their lives as living a life of comfortless treadmill existence, wanting more, striving to get it, never reaching the end, always walking the treadmill. But you and I, brethren, are privileged to have a different perspective on things. By the Lord's grace, we have a tremendous amount of knowledge that the world doesn't have. And because of that knowledge, we have a perspective from the Lord rather than from the earth. We know why sin was allowed. We know why men die. We know why God let it all happen and seems to stand idly by. We know what God expects of us as Christians and what he will expect from the world and the kingdom. We know about his promises of eternal life, and all of this gives us hope in knowing that wealth, position, and power and stature in the world are not the real answers to happiness. We know another thing that's important in combating discontent, the discontent that the world would like us to share with them. We know that God has promised that all things work together for good to them that love God and to them that are called according to his purpose. Paul's argument is that the reason we can be content with the things that we have is that God has said, I will never leave thee or forsake thee. That's our source of contentment, our relationship with him. We know that the Lord said, are not five sparrows sold for two farthings, and not one of them is forgotten before God, but even the hairs of your head are numbered? Fear not, therefore, ye are of more value than the sparrows. This is the real basis of contentment, seeing things from God's perspective, not from man's. The knowledge that God has promised to supervise our lives, and that his wisdom and grace are working in us in our daily experiences. Many brethren can attest to the fact that trials have often resulted in the richest blessings from the Lord, blessing that they could never have had if it was not because of the trial. We have to believe that the experiences he chooses for us are the best for our spiritual welfare, because he's infinitely more qualified to know what's best for us. This was the faith Jesus had. Remember how we answered Pilate when Pilate said, "Don't you know that I have power to crucify you or set you free?" And Jesus said, "Thou couldst have no power except it were given thee of my Father." He recognized God's supervision and permissive will working in his life. Jesus had said earlier, "The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" He recognized the Father's wisdom in knowing how to pour his cup of experiences. The principle which helped Jesus have the courage to suffer and gladly bear his trials was the belief that the Father was controlling every matter and that there was a wise purpose in them. The lesson of faith, then, is to have a real, living, daily confidence in God, that he has promised to be with us and that he's able and willing to keep that promise. John said, "This is the victory that overcometh the world, even your faith." And so the antidote for discontent is faith in God's wisdom and direction. If we can gain this confidence in him, then all our joys will be deeper. Our burdens and our sorrows will be borne with greater strength. Brethren, it's a tool that really works. It's a practical tool that we have to keep with us at all times, faith in the Father. It helps us to put our lives in the greater context of eternity. How important are the things that we are presently lacking, or the things that are making us happy, unhappy? When we view our lives in this context of eternity, when we look at our lives as how they will be in 1,000 years or 10,000 or 1,000,000, what will we be doing in those thousands of years from now? If you think of what you will be doing then and what God's purpose is for you then, the things that make us discontent and unhappy now are so relatively unimportant. God designs for us with that perspective in mind, not this perspective, which we often have. And it can help us to try to look at our lives with that perspective. Another remedy for discouragement is hope. Hope in the future prospects which lie ahead, which is very similar to what we just said. I think a very beneficial exercise for us to practice from time to time is to look around us, look at the world, look at the things that are happening, and try to imagine how these things will be affected by the establishment of the kingdom. Is there anything in this world that will not be affected by the kingdom? That's how universal God's plan is. When we see suffering, when we see sadness and pain, when we see injustice, try to picture how those things will be eliminated by the reign that you personally will be a part of. What effect is Tom Ruggiero going to have on the world of mankind someday by the Lord's grace? We need to know that by his grace we can make a difference, that we will make a difference in the kingdom under God's arrangements. Try to picture your part in lifting up a sorrowful world out of unbelief, out of the many superstitions and God-dishonoring doctrines, into a clear knowledge of the Lord, and the tremendous difference that will make for each and every individual who has ever lived. Try to picture the ancient worthies putting in a day's work. Try to picture what they will be doing, where they will be going, what they will be saying to people. And even think beyond the millennial age to the prospects of possibly bringing life to other parts of the universe. Try to feel the joy that we will have in working with other saints, other body members of Christ, in whatever future work the Lord has in store. Think of never tiring, of never needing sleep, of never feeling alone. Think of the ability you will have of unlimited service and praise to the Heavenly Father of this whole creation. Think of actually seeing God face to face, what you'll say to him, and how you'll thank him for being your Father and guiding you along the narrow, rugged way in the past. This isn't vain imagining, brethren, but living for your hope. Living for the kingdom that God has planned. It's making your beliefs real and vital and living. In 1 Thessalonians 5:8, Paul tells us to put on for a helmet the hope of salvation. Hope can be a shield from the things that come into our minds that so often discourage us. It can keep out the arrows of discontent, realizing that God is working in us something far greater than the pain of our trials or the things that we might lack. So when God told the Apostle Paul, that my grace is sufficient for you. He meant that for you and me as well. Recently, I came across an article on long-distance running. And it talked about it from a perspective I had never heard before. It talked about long-distance running from the aspect of the emotions that are involved. I never thought of emotions being involved in running long-distance race, but they are. And this is the advice it gives. It says, run the entire race course in your mind first. Relish the parts of the course you enjoy, like the downgrades and the picturesque views, and try to find positive qualities at every point of difficulty. Be sure to find a vision that satisfies you. You can't fake good, happy thoughts or con your body. Taking control of your emotions in this way will prove invaluable in training and competition. That's an article on running. And yet it has such a good spiritual application, because our race course in Christianity is like a long-distance race. Run the entire course in your mind. Picture what your life should be like. Plan it. Reason on it. Relish the parts of the course that you enjoy. Relish the conventions. Relish the things in life that are spiritually pleasing to you. And try to find positive points, positive qualities at every point of difficulty. Look for the lesson in your trials. Look for what the Lord is trying to teach you. Look for how He's trying to elevate you by this trial. And there'll be reason for the trial. Be sure to find a vision that satisfies you. And what greater vision can satisfy than the kingdom we all pray for? But it has to be real and inspiring. You can't fake happy thoughts. I guess I can't paraphrase that any better. Taking control of your emotions in this way will prove invaluable in spiritual training. I realize, brethren, that there are some very difficult trials that many of you have gone through, and I don't wish to minimize them by simply saying you have to have more faith or you should have a positive mental attitude. I realize how difficult life can be at times. But when we are ready to look for the answers, there's only one real source of comfort. There's only one real source of strength that we can turn to. Often the answers sound theoretical, but they are the answers, and we have to learn how to make them practical. Many of the brethren have lost loved ones, and I don't think there's anything more difficult than turning to an empty bed or having one place setting at the dinner table when we're used to putting two. Brethren, we need to continually remind ourselves to take comfort in the promises. The same comfort that we offer to the world in our witness message is also the source of comfort for ourselves. We will soon see our loved ones again. The pain and emptiness we might feel today will only be a memory as we go into eternity. And we should take comfort in our brethren as well. Let them fill our void. Share together the love that we have and the hope that we cherish. We need to live together in that hope. An isolated person cannot survive in today's world. Peter tells us in 1 Peter 1:13, brace up your minds, and as men who know what they are doing, rest the full weight of your hopes on the grace that will be yours when Jesus Christ reveals Himself. Habakkuk said, though the vision seem to tarry, wait for it. Lamentations 3:26 says, it is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. And Paul assures us that God will not suffer us to be tempted above that which we are able to bear. I realize too, brethren, that there are many causes for discouragement that we haven't covered. Some are very complicated and some are less. You know, a number of years ago, a sister said that her physical condition often had a lot to do with her discouragement. She finally realized that a good night's sleep meant a great deal in your mental outlook. In fact, she said that sometimes she would go to bed at night convinced that she was in second death, and when she woke up in the morning, she was back in the church class. Even in that way, we have to know ourselves. We shouldn't let our physical limitations make us think that there's something tragically wrong with our new creatures. Sometimes our flesh just needs recuperation. Brethren, may the Lord help us all to combat discouragement with the tools that He's given us. Prayer, meditation, friendship, communication of the brethren, faith in God, and the wonderful, inspiring, thrilling hope of the kingdom.
Thank you, Brother Tom. We thank God and we thank you. And our suggestion, in harmony with Brother Tom's discourse, is that we find a kindred spirit here at this convention, brother or sister, and not be afraid to say, I need some help. I need some help. Or be on the other end of it and be willing to give some help. And that's one of the lessons that I'm learning at the present time, is to not be afraid to call somebody or talk to somebody and say, I need help. I need help. So thank you, Brother Tom. It's such a privilege to share with our brethren, and oftentimes they feel so good. We really give that brother or that sister a privilege that they wouldn't have had otherwise. You know, it's the way that we feel sometimes. Somebody will ask us for our help and so on. So we've got a half an hour intermission, and during this intermission, we understand that Brother Steve Roskowitz's funeral will take place at 11 o'clock. And Steve has served us many, many times here in Jackson, many times. And so we would like to remember the family of Brother Roskowitz in this intermission, and maybe in Tom's prayer also. We would ask him to say something on that. And then we'll meet back here at 11:15 for Brother David Stein. And we're grateful for Brother Tom's service and to our Heavenly Father for this convention.
Dear Father, we come before Thee grateful for Thy many promises You've given to us. We thank You for the privilege of coming close to Thee and knowing that You will accept us and be our Father. We thank You for watching over our daily experiences and pray that You will help us to deal with our emotions and our discouragements and help us to turn to Thee in prayer and meditation and to seek a closer bond with our brethren. We now pray a special blessing on the brethren who have, in the Roskowitz family. Pray that You will comfort them with the truth as they have comforted others. Help us to feel the closeness with one another more deeply and to feel the suffering and pain of one another. We commit ourselves into this convention into Thy loving care and keeping in Jesus' name.